Part 9 of Vanished Amelia Earhart contains historical archival audio footage. We'd like to thank both Elgin Long and Dave Bellarts for allowing us to feature this testimony on tonight's show. This program is a theoretical account of the events that occurred on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, and thereafter. Although she was declared dead in absentia on January the 5th, 1939, there are many that believe the case of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan remains unsolved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com. On June the 29th, 1937, a tired Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan touched down in Ley, New Guinea, having reached the three-quarter mark of their record attempt at circumnavigating the globe. Long days of flight had brought A.E. and Noonan to the likes of Brazil, Dakar, Bangkok, and Darwin, Australia, just to name a few. Though she was anxious to complete her long journey and fly into the record books, the next day, June 30th, 1937, A.E. sent a telegram to her husband, George Palmer Putnam, that read, quote, "Radio misunderstanding and personnel unfitness. Probably will hold one day," end quote. What these personnel problems meant has been debated for many years. Were they related to Fred Noonan? Whatever the issues might have been, A.E. didn't let them derail her plans. She and Noonan took off from Ley on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, at 10 a.m. local time. It was the last that anyone would ever see them. While Earhart's plane was in the air, the Coast Guard cutter Itasca was waiting to guide her into Howland Island. However, due to A.E.'s friend Jean Fidel no longer being at the Bureau of Air Commerce to direct subordinates to smooth her way, some of the ship's communications were on bandwidths that she didn't have the ability to receive. There were other difficulties. A radio direction finder on Howland that would work with Earhart's higher bandwidth equipment required batteries, which were drained by the time she was in the area. 14 hours and 15 minutes into her flight, the Itasca received a first somewhat garbled transmission from Earhart about, quote, "cloudy weather," end quote. Though the messages themselves would grow clearer, their content remained worrying, as when Earhart radioed, quote, "we must be on you but cannot see you," end quote. She apparently only received one message from the ship, though the Itasca had been transmitting for hours. While continuing to broadcast, the radio strength of her communications indicated she was close. Earhart remained unable to see Howland Island. The weather around Howland was clear, but there are reports of clouds about 30 miles northwest. And if Earhart had flown into clouds and bad weather along the way, it could have prevented Noonan from taking the sightings he needed to navigate precisely. There's also some evidence to indicate that the charts that Noonan and Earhart were using were not entirely accurate. Earhart's last transmission made 20 hours and 14 minutes into her flight, indicated that they were going to continue, quote, "running north and south," end quote. The Electra never made it to Howland. Tonight we dive into the events that occurred while A.E. and Noonan were at Ley, some controversial and some head-scratching. We'll also climb aboard the Electra with A.E. and Noonan and try to unravel the beginnings of one of the greatest mysteries of all time. What actually happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan that day? Tonight, the trial continues as we bring someone to the stand that you'll never see coming. Time to get to work. Now that the opening day of trial is behind us, I had to collect my thoughts and try to digest everything that's unfolded as we've started this dive. More importantly, before I begin day two of this trial, I wanted to catch up with my partner, Jennifer, and get her thoughts on Tad's testimony and on what we're about to cover on the second day of this incredible experiment. What we're going to try to pull off next is quite groundbreaking, and I wanted to ask her how to do it. What did you think of the first day of trial? How did you think it went?
Well, I thought Tad did a phenomenal job on the stand. I mean, it's undeniable that he is the expert on prosecuting and investigating a no-body murder case. And so I've read his book. It's amazing. He really knows his stuff. I thought the most interesting part of that conversation was when he was talking about victimology, having a thorough understanding of your victim. And so in this case, Fred and Amelia, who they were and, you know, how they spent their time, the fact that she was famous, is he as famous as she is? I know that he talked about her fame. He talked about how he said, I don't know how famous she was, but I'm thinking Lindbergh, I'm thinking Babe Ruth kind of fame. That would be, he made this point that it would be really hard for her to come back and no one notice until the 1960s. And that was really something that probably I should have, but I hadn't really thought about that until he said it. And then I thought, well, is that also true for Fred? And, you know, what does it mean to be famous in 1937 versus being famous in 2019, where we have Instagram and Twitter and 24-hour news cycles? And it just got me thinking about a lot of things. So I thought that in particular was really interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. When we talk about this case in media and all this other stuff, I always try to push Fred Noonan as much as I can, because there was a second person in that plane, and we really try to shine the spotlight on him. Unfortunately, and I was just talking with Robert Wheeler earlier today, but unfortunately, there is not a whole lot of information on Fred Noonan. When he was newly remarried at the time that he disappeared with Amelia Earhart, and his wife B Noonan at the time sort of went into hiding. And when she went into hiding, you know, that's basically the last most people have ever heard of her. And he never had children, so there's not really much lineage there. So it's really kind of sad, and we want to make sure Fred Noonan gets the spotlight he deserves. And we're actually working on trying to track down genealogy right now on Fred Noonan and trying to see if we can get any kind of extended family in any way, shape, or form, so we can kind of talk to them or you know, bring them into the fold when it comes to what we're doing. So yeah, he was definitely. He was key. And I think a lot of people, when you ask him, he was key to the vanishing, I think. I mean, a lot of people would say that. So yeah, he's a key figure for sure.
Yeah. So yeah, based on some of his testimony there, I think as we move into at least the Irene Bolam theory, that's questions based on what he said. I think those are definitely questions that we should keep in the back of our mind. You know, how famous was she? And did that fame extend to her image? So of course people knew her name, but did they also know her face? And I think that especially for young people right now, I know most of us weren't around in 1937, but especially young people today, if you're famous, you are going to recognize that person if you see them on the street, more than likely. We have Instagram stars, we have Twitter, we have social media, it's when you're famous, people know what you look like. But that's just, I think that maybe that's something we take for granted today. And so maybe it was the same in 1937, but I think that's definitely something maybe we should explore. And we should say, you know, we should ask, if she was to have come back and tried to live under an assumed name, how difficult would that have been for her, given her level of fame? I think that's definitely something we should try to ask ourselves. So I thought that was an interesting point that he made. I also thought whenever he was talking about victimology, I also, you know, thought back to, you know, the first 7 episodes of this show have been doing exactly that, learning who she is, learning, you know, why she was doing what she was doing, and maybe trying to get a better understanding of her as a person. And that way, maybe we could understand what happened to her. So I thought that those were all really great points. Another thing that really struck me about him and his testimony was that he obviously does not have a pet theory yet. A lot of these people that you've talked to, and a lot of these people that, you know, we're going to hear from later, a lot of them have already an idea in their head about what happened to her. And some of them probably a lot of them are not going to be shy about telling you that. They're going to say, this is what I think, and this is why I think that. And whenever they come testify, they're going to defend that theory. That's what they are there to do. But he's not really in that position. And I think he's really unique. for that, because he said he did say that he leaned toward a certain theory, but he also said, you know, I've been researching this for 2 days, and I think that what I've seen so far, I mean, maybe there is reasonable doubt to the crash and sink theory. And so you can definitely see that that he is open, that he hasn't made up his mind yet. And so I think that anytime you have, just in any situation, anytime you have an expert on the stand that up front is willing to say, hey, you know, I'm not here on behalf of anybody. This is what I think, and this is why I think that. And they're not there to defend their position. They're just there to give you their honest thoughts. I mean, that's something that's really rare, but it also kind of changes your tactic when you're cross-examining them, right? You don't have to be as aggressive with them. If you have an expert on the stand and you know for a fact that they're not going to change their opinion, it will do you absolutely no good to start asking them questions and start trying to get them to change their opinion in front of a jury, because it's not going to happen. You would be wasting your time.
Yeah, that's, you make a good point. I think what was interesting about him was he, I like at the end how he told me in court that our job would be to really sway the jury to say, hey, look at this over here. You know, the official explanation of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan is that they crashed just shy of Howland Island, somewhere in that vicinity, and that's that. But look at what all these other theories have to offer. And I think that's one of the interesting things. I like how we kind of mentioned that on the stand. That was really interesting, I thought.
Yeah. And in the real world, that does happen. If you actually were prosecuting a murder case, for example, there's limits on how you would do that, but you can do it. So for example, if, you know, he was a prosecutor and he was trying to prosecute my client for a murder and we didn't have a body and it was that situation, I, as the defense attorney, I could say, well, here are some alternative theories about what could have happened to her. Here are some leads that the police didn't follow. But say my theory is that, you know, maybe I represent the husband. As I know he mentioned, most nobody victims are females, and most of the time it's going to be a boyfriend or husband. We'll say that that's who I represent. I represent this person's husband, but I think it was an intruder. I think that she was, somebody came into her house and burglarized and killed her that way. It's really hard to actually put somebody else on trial who's not present to defend themselves. And so a judge will often say, look, you can't go into that. We're not going to have a trial on two people at once. But what you can do is you can say, hey, there's evidence out there that maybe points to something else having happened, or maybe the police didn't do a thorough investigation. Maybe they didn't follow all leads. And so you can still get that stuff in, but you have to frame it a little bit differently. What we're doing here, we actually are putting all five theories on trial. So we are in a unique situation where we can say, hey, actually, we have a whole other line of evidence and we can follow it and we have the time to do that. And so it's really cool what we're doing.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. And the first day of trial was a lot of fun. I think it was interesting, and we're calling general expertise. Now, I wanted to ask you, you're a defense attorney, he's a prosecutor. Obviously, you're going to come at something like this from a different point of view. Was there anything that he said on the stand that you didn't agree with, professionally speaking? Or is there anything that you would have come at differently? I mean, what did you think about his testimony in that aspect of it? Was there anything that you had a hard time with?
There's nothing that I would say that I disagreed with professionally. I did notice, as I said, I think I made a comment in our Facebook group saying something similar, but I did notice that when he was talking, he says, well, my first instinct would to maybe prosecute the ocean, maybe do crash and sink. And I just kind of laughed to myself a little bit whenever I heard it, because when you first approached me and I started looking at everything, my first instinct was almost the opposite. I kind of was like, I want to hear more about, you know, a conspiracy theory involving her being a spy. Like that's kind of where my mind went. And I think it just goes to show you that when you have a certain job, it does affect how you think about things. If he's a prosecutor and he's worked for the government, it would totally make sense for him to, for his starting point to be, this is what happened. This is easy to understand. This is what the government said happened. Why not start here? Whereas me, my first instinct when I hear something that the government has told me, my first instinct is to say, no, don't trust any of it, question everything. And of course, that doesn't mean that I don't think that he's biased at all. I don't think he's married to Crash and Sink. He even said himself he wasn't. Just like, I mean, I don't think that, at least I, maybe somebody else would disagree, but if there's evidence of Crash and Sink, I'm totally happy to hear it. You know, like, so I don't think it's necessarily going to affect our ability to look at everything, but it just, I think my point is that every single person, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter how long you've been studying this case, every single person comes at a problem with their own personal experience. And we all have these little biases. And just recognizing them is important, because anytime somebody says anything, you always have to ask yourself, like, well, you know, what is it, like, do they have anything like that? Do they have these internal biases that might be making them say certain things over certain other things?
So now that we've talked a little bit about what happened on the first day of trial in part 8 of Vanished, I want to get into part 9 and what we're about to tackle, because what we're about to do, and especially one of the witnesses we're about to call, is really sort of groundbreaking in how we're going to do that. Of course, we'll get to that in a little bit. But I want to ask you, one of the main points of contention for what happened when Earhart and Noonan left Lay, between the time they left Lay and should have shown up at Howland or did show up around Howland and ended up crashing and sinking in the ocean, is fuel. And you've been actually tackling this pretty aggressively in the last couple of weeks in our Facebook group and just doing personal research, prepping for this episode and talking to me. Tell me what you've learned. Tell me some of the stuff that you've kind of uncovered. Let's get into the fuel a little bit, and because that's one of the areas that we're going to talk about when we question a specific witness a little later on.
I started with Bill Snavely's theory because he's the one, more than anyone else, that has said she started with 950 gallons of fuel. One of his main points has always been this: that's because that's how much it could carry, like that was its weight capacity. And so therefore, this is how much she had. We all know that she was fueled up to weight capacity. I think there's even a statement. I actually found that statement as well. But okay, so just to kind of walk you through how I researched this, I had heard from you that Bill Snavely got that number from a book called The Sound of Wings by Mary Lovell. I went and rented that book on Kindle, and she does discuss fuel at length in things like Appendix B. And so I read all of that, and she had a number of footnotes in her book that kind of explains this is where I got these numbers from. When she says Fred Noonan told a reporter the night before that they had put 950 gallons of fuel into the plane, there's a little footnote there. And it says that she got that from a newspaper article dated July 7th, 1937, and she names the newspaper. After quite a lot of time on the internet, I was able to find an image of that exact newspaper article. And I put that in, I think you put it in the Facebook group. One of us put it in the Facebook group.
Right. You showed it to me, and then we talked about it via text, and then I went ahead and stuck it in the Facebook group, and we started talking about it there.
Okay, so a couple of things. If you read the article, the wording it's not really clear that that information came from Fred Noonan. Fred Noonan said something to the effect of, we are 2 tons overweight, something like that. And then the article goes on to talk about how much fuel that the plane had, what rations they had and things like that. And so the way that it's worded, that information could have come from Fred Noonan, but that's not clear that that's what happened. And so I thought, okay, so we don't know for a fact that that number came from Fred Noonan. Where did that number come from? That's the first thing. The second thing, though, is that she also mentions in her book that Lay used imperial gallons instead of U.S. gallons. And she kind of mentions that, well, maybe some of this confusion could have been because, you know, we're talking about apples and oranges. And so I looked into that a little bit further, and I think she's right about that, but I think she's wrong in her conclusion, that she might be wrong in her conclusion that it had 950 gallons. Or if she, maybe she's not. I just, she isn't clear. And also the article doesn't say 950 US gallons. It also doesn't say 950 imperial gallons. It just says 950 gallons. It leaves it unspecified. And when you go into Google and you can pull up a converter and you can say convert imperial gallons to US gallons, type in 950 in imperial, and it brings up 1140.9 US liquid gallons. And then if you go find, there's a letter that I found. It was a letter written by James Colopy. It was written on August 27th, which is actually about almost 2 months after the news article came out. It appears to contradict the article because he says that, and this is a quote, according to Captain Noonan, the total fuel capacity of the aircraft was 1150 US gallons and 64 US gallons of oil. So 1150 US gallons of fuel, 64 US gallons of oil. They left Ley with a total of 1100 US gallons. And he even gets very specific and says one tank contained only 50 gallons of its total capacity of 100. This tank contained 100 octane fuel. So he's very specific, but he also says 1100 US gallons. And so it's possible that they're actually saying the same thing, that 1100 US gallons is the same as 950 imperial gallons, and that the reporter and the letter are both right. But because we're not being specific enough about our unit of measurement, that's where the confusion comes in. And I just, you know, just thinking about it, I know that that plane didn't have, I don't know how many fuel tanks it initially had, but I know that there were some added, right? Because they were going to be doing long distance flights and they knew that they needed more fuel. So there was like 6 or 12 additional fuel tanks added to the wing and to the fuselage. And so my thinking, and, you know, of course we can go into this with experts and people that know more about planes than I do, but my thinking was, if adding an additional fuel tank is going to add weight to the plane, why do it unless you're actually going to use that fuel tank? And so if you're only flying around with 900 or 950 US gallons of fuel, then you have, basically you have an extra fuel tank that you don't need, because if the total capacity for one tank is 100 gallons, then you could just take, and maybe it has to do with weight distribution, like you need an even number on each side, but to me it still seems like you're adding too many tanks and you're adding weight that's completely unnecessary. And so I would think that they're going to use as much of it as they can. I don't know, but again, this is just I don't know anything about planes, so that might be something that you might want to go into with some of the people that are going to come on and talk about that stuff, somebody who is smarter than I am and knows more about it than I do. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, you make some good points. And I talked to Robert Wheeler for quite a long time today. And he mentioned, basically, he came to the same conclusion that you just did regarding the imperial gallons versus US gallons. He said that he spoke with Gary LaPook. Actually, Gary LaPook in our Facebook group, I believe, put some information out there that sort of proves that, you know, that speculation. It's not even speculation. It basically has been taken care of already. It's been quote unquote debunked, I should say. And so that's going to put a damper on Bill Snavely's Buka theory. But it should be noted that Robert Wheeler does believe that Bill Snavely is very much onto something, and that very well could be the plane in Buka. So it's one of those things where, you know, we don't know what we don't know at this point. And that's kind of the thing. There's so much vagueness in a lot of this material. Every once in a while you get something that's very, very specific, but for the most part, there's a lot of vagueness to it, or there's a lot of conflicting reports, you know, all over the place. And so you're trying to get out what is the actual definitive report, what is the definitive opinion on this. And it's really not unlike multiple experts on a stand challenging each other, or multiple experts, one for defense, one for prosecution, disagreeing with the same result, or disagreeing with the same test, or they're getting different results in the same type of test or whatever. It's kind of the same concept here. So we're gonna dive into it with a witness that I think would really trump most people just a little later on. So I think it's gonna be pretty interesting to see what that witness has to say and how their opinion factors into everything.
Yeah, I think this is why it's always important to start with the data and then move to a theory instead of starting with a theory and trying to work backwards and finding data that fits that theory. And so when you have something...
Yeah, that's called confirmation bias.
Right, of course. Absolutely. And a lot of the times when you have competing experts and they have competing opinions, when you really dig down into why that is, maybe sometimes they're using different science, but maybe sometimes they're using the same science, or maybe they're both using good science and good methods, but the information that they're getting might be different. And so that's, it's always something that you need to explore as well. And I think this is a big one because, I mean, it doesn't seem like 950 versus 1100 versus 1150 gallons of fuel, like, doesn't seem like that much, but it turns out this makes a pretty big difference on some of these theories.
Yeah, well, when you factor into the idea and factor into the fray that headwinds were an issue and, you know, the type of weather they might have been facing was an issue, all that stuff sort of adds into the fray. I just think it's possible that they just really had a very bad day. There's all kinds of stuff that they didn't anticipate. Again, I spoke with Robert Wheeler today, and he mentioned that the headwinds actually were anticipated. They did kind of count those headwinds into it. So it's one of those situations where you have to kind of go with what you know and go with what the history tells you. And history tells you that she was en route to Howland Island with Fred Noonan, and that they incorporated a multitude of potential issues. They never established two-way radio connection. That was one of the most interesting aspects of it. You know, Howland was a floating needle in a haystack. It was 2 miles long, 1 mile wide, roughly, give or take. And it's almost invisible from the sky, especially if it's cloudy. You can barely see it. There is the question of why Amelia Earhart dropped down to 1,000 feet below cloud cover, because really at 1,000 feet, you cannot see Howland Island. That's I can almost with certainty tell you it's an impossibility. We have this thing that we do with kids when we do History Day talks, and we try to explain to them and kind of relate to them how you can, the whole Howland Island situation, what they were up against, how difficult was this island to spot. And a good way you did this, and I stole this idea from Doug Westfall, who's a good friend of mine and a friend of the show, is that you take a kid outside, you take a pen or a pencil, you lay the pencil on the cement on the sidewalk, you have the kid back up 3 houses down, you have them lay their head on the sidewalk and ask them if they can see the pen. And most of the time, they can't see the pen because it's 3 houses down. It's not visible. Then you tell them, okay, let's walk a block down, and you tell me if you can see the pen. That's basically what they were up against, to kind of put a visual on it. It was almost impossible to see Howland on that particular day. And I think it scared her. I think it scared her and Noonan. I think they could have been off. It's possible with the navigation, the weather, the clouds. It could have been a multitude of things that just added up to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan having a very, very bad day that day.
That seems to happen in life. It's not ever just one thing that goes wrong. It's going to be 1,000 things going on at the same time. So, I mean, I can definitely see that.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is she mentioned early in the flight, and I have it on record somewhere, but I got to find it. I'm going to try to put it in the show notes for tonight's episode if we can find it. She basically foreshadowed this exact problem. She said earlier in the flight, or even before they left Hawaii for the flight, if anything is going to go wrong, if we're going to experience anything potentially fatal, it's going to be in this leg. And that, when I heard that the first time, I really get sent chills up my spine. It's almost like she foreshadowed her own death, if that's actually what happened, if they did end up just crashing off the coast of Howland somewhere, you know, 100 miles out, 200 miles out. Now, I did speak, again, at length with Robert Wheeler, and I asked him the same question that we're going to be talking about later tonight and on part 10. And that question has to do with signal strengths and radio communication. I asked him, as far as Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan are concerned, how far out can that Electra be from the Itasca and the Electra still pull S5s? S5s is the strongest signal strength that they can pull at the time. So if you're pulling an S1 or an S2, you're 1,000 miles out or thousands of miles out. You're barely detectable. If you're pulling an S5, according to Robert Wheeler, who will be hopefully on this show later down the line, he states that around the 200-mile mark, they should start to pull S5s. And Earhart indicated, I'm 200 miles out, I'm 100 miles out, I must be on you but cannot see you. That seems to line up. So that's, you start to see some of the data, some of the math, some of the factual information sort of line up with what the crash and sink hypothesis, which we'll cover on part 10, is basically stating, hey, she simply ran out of gas, and that plane lies 18,000 feet, give or take, down, you know, beneath the surface of the ocean as we speak right now.
Mm-hmm. There's so much, though, so many other questions then, if that's the case. Like, for one, I have one of the collateral consequences of me looking through dozens and dozens of newspaper articles from 1937 was apparently her husband, George Putnam, he had apparently told reporters around that time that the plane should float indefinitely. And that was repeated in the newspapers around that time quite a bit. And I can, if you want, I can try and find some more links and put them in the Facebook group, because the media really hung on to that statement because everyone was really hopeful that they would find her. And just, so that's what he was telling the media, was that no, that plane on no fuel, that should have been floating. And so it should have, like, they should have been able to find her if they knew that she was within 100 to 200 miles of the island, they should have been able to find her. But then something else that I never knew until I was also reading these newspaper articles from around this time was, I don't remember which ship, but there was, I believe, a U.S. Navy ship. I can double check exactly which one it was, but one of them encountered really bad weather when they were looking for her. When I say really bad weather, we're talking hail and snow. I mean, we're on the equator, and so when I read that, I was like, oh, that's so weird that you're getting, like, and it's July. But they encountered, like, ice and things like that, and they couldn't look for her because the conditions were too bad, and so they had to call off the search. And I didn't really get a whole lot of information about how long were they out there, and, you know, when did they have to pull back, and when were they able to go back after that. And so that's something else, you know, maybe she was there, maybe she was there, and maybe if there wasn't bad weather, maybe people would have been able to find her. But, or maybe the bad weather moved the plane, maybe it caused it to sink at a faster rate than it should have. Or, I mean, there's just so many things that I don't know. Like, once you start trying to answer one question, then five more questions, then now you have to go find the answers to those. And so it's been a little bit frustrating.
That's the very definition of a rabbit hole. My wife and I always joke, this whole case is like whack-a-mole. It really is. That's exactly how it is. And to your point you made earlier about the plane floating indefinitely. So that, even that's a point of contention. I've talked to multiple people that agree with you, that say, yes, the plane would have been like their exact words were a ping pong ball with wings. That's what it would have been like. And it could have floated indefinitely. However, Elgin Long, who is an aviation pioneer and is really the pioneer of the crash and sink hypothesis, states that plane would have sank almost immediately. And so does Tom Detweiler agrees with that, that if the plane, it really depends on how she was able to put the plane down on the water. So if she was able to pancake land the plane and put the plane down in a soft enough manner that they could have floated, it's possible. But if she put the plane down in a nosedive, which is unlikely, or if she put the plane down and it got pierced, something happened, because, you know, the plane itself was not really ruggedly made, and one of the tanks got pierced or something like that, the tank starts to fill with water immediately. It doesn't take long for the plane to go down. The other argument, if I'm playing the devil's advocate against you here, is that if she was in fact able to put the plane down in the water, and let's say they were able to float for a while, the radio communications, all the post-loss radio communications that we'll get to in the Castaway episode, would directly dispute that, because the radio on the Electra would not have worked. She would not have been able to send those post-loss radio signals if the radio was submerged in water, which tells us that the Electra had to have been on land. If we're going to follow that thread, that she ended up continuing on and actually running into Nicomororo at the time, or Gardner Island is actually the proper term. It's Nicu now, but it's Gardner then that's the way she was able to actually send out the post-loss radio signals, which all happened to, if you look at some of the data and talk to some of the experts, which we will, they all happen to triangulate in what area? Nicomororo Island.
A lot of the, again, going back to some of these articles that I read, and these were all, like, very specific to New Guinea and Australia, because the site that I was on, that's just, those were the newspapers that they had archived. I'm sure that I could spend just as many hours going through others, but that was one of the theories they were floating, is that because they were talking about these signals that were coming in, and they were saying, oh, she must be stranded on an island somewhere. We should. And so I think that the theory was out there that we know that she was in a certain certain mile radius of Howland Island, and some people are picking up these signals. Why don't we go look? Let's go look at these islands that are within there. And so I don't think this is something that was neglected at the time. And so that's another question I would definitely have when we get to that theory is, well, these islands that she was supposedly at, were they looked for? Or not were they looked for, but have they been searched? And how thoroughly were they searched?
You know, the question as you're talking about stuff and you know, before we sort of get to day two of trial, I want to ask you this. There's so many experts. You know this now. You're starting to kind of dip your feet in now. So you kind of know how this works. There's so many experts that are involved in this case. There's multiple camps. It's not just prosecution versus defense. It's like, it's, you know, it's a five-way trial is really what this is. And there's so many experts and there's so many people that vehemently disagree with each other and have their own set of data or have their own answers, have their own facts. You know, and people even disagree on that. You know, you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own set of facts. That's debatable depending on who you talk to as well. How do we now as a team here, how do we determine what experts to put on the stand? How do we determine which experts to sort of cherry pick from the bunch and best represent all these different hypotheses?
We put all of them on the stand, all of them. I mean, of course, there's all of those things that we talked about in episode 8 about making sure that Rule 702 and the rules of evidence have been satisfied. We don't want to give somebody a platform when they're obviously repeating junk science or if they obviously don't know what they're doing. That's what that is for. But like I said last episode, when you are looking at Rule 702 and you're looking at Daubert, this is supposed to be something that it's supposed to be a flexible analysis. That's just step one. That's the judge's gatekeeper role. Is this something that we can rely upon? And is it something that is relevant? And if there's enough information out there on this person and on what they're going to say that we can trust that it is something that is reliable and something that is relevant, then let the jury hear it. And so I think that, yeah, if every side has their expert and they can sufficiently show that this is somebody that we can rely upon, then let us hear it. Because at the end of the day, the more information that a jury has, the better. Because then they can make a more informed decision. What we don't want to do is we don't want to give them things that sound great because it's coming from somebody that's claiming to be knowledgeable. It turns out that it's just complete junk. That's what Rule 702 does, is it keeps out the things that are going to skew in favor of injustice. But I mean, yeah, if every person has their own opinion and they have something that they can back that up, let's get it all out there and then we can break it down and we can maybe explain to the jury, explain to your listeners, like, okay, this is what they were saying, this is why they said it, and here are the reasons why other people have a different opinion.
Yeah, well, speaking of putting everybody on the stand, we're about to, right off the bat, throw a curveball at our jury that I don't think they're ever going to see coming.
Awesome. I can't wait.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about before we start day two of trial is the video. You've seen the video. A lot of people have seen the video of the takeoff at Ley with Earhart Noonan. I mean, I know that you've studied these types of videos for modern day cases and DUI cases and things like that. A lot of people would agree that Noonan may not have been obviously not drunk the morning they took off, but he was hungover. You've seen, you know, the brief clip. Give us your thoughts on the brief clip from a criminal standpoint.
Yeah, I watched that video and I'm just going to be completely, I have never, I don't see any signs of intoxication on that video or any signs of impairment on that video at all. I mean, I know it's only a few seconds that we get of him. I think, like you said, the video itself is less than a minute long, and even less of that is Fred Noonan. So there is that caveat. But to be completely honest, I didn't see any type of anything that would convince me that he's intoxicated, like none at all. I mean, when you're doing, and I know maybe this is a little bit different, but when you're doing a DWI investigation in today's day, we have a lot more information available to us. We'll have like a DWI, like we'll have a dash cam video, and we'll have, you know, maybe somebody will take a sample of their breath or blood, or they'll be doing field sobriety testing, and you can, you know, pay close attention to whether or not they're losing their balance, or whether they can divide their attention. Because that's one of the things that you're really going to look for when you're trying to determine whether or not somebody is too drunk to drive is, can they divide their attention between two different things? So like, for example, when you're doing a field sobriety test, you'll tell them, okay, I want you to stand in this position with your feet here and your arms here. And I want you to listen to the instructions I'm about to give you. And then you tell them how to perform the test. And one of the things you're looking for before the test even starts is, can they stand there in the position like you've asked them to, and also listen to your instructions? Because that requires doing two things at once, which is what driving requires. And I'm sure also flying and trying to do complicated navigational techniques. You have to be able to, you know, listen to somebody and also drive, also pay attention to the road signs, also pay attention to other people in traffic. Whenever they pull you over and they say, for example, I need your license and your registration, they ask for two things on purpose, because you're supposed so that you can look for two things at once. And while you're doing that, they might ask you other questions. You're looking through your wallet. Well, where are you coming from? Where are you headed? They're doing that on purpose when they pull you over, because they want to see, can you actually do two things at once? Can you listen to them and respond appropriately to their questions, and also look for your insurance card like you've been asked? If you can't do that, you fumble with those things, that's going to be their first clue that maybe you're intoxicated, and they're going to ask you to step out of your vehicle, or they're going to ask you if you've been drinking, things like that. So when I see that, he's excited and he's happy, and they're getting ready for takeoff. He's jumping onto the plane. He's pulling her up. I don't see any kind of imbalance. I think I see nothing. I don't think that there's anything there. If all the evidence you had of intoxication is just that video and nothing else, I would say that you've done a terrible job. You have no evidence of that he was intoxicated that day.
Agreed, 100%. Now we're heading into day two of trial, and we're going to be putting a couple of witnesses on the stand today. You know, how do you think we're doing so far?
I think we're doing great so far. So far, all I've heard is Tad. I haven't heard anyone else yet, but I think we're off to a really good start. I think that Tad kind of ended his testimony with, well, I think that it makes sense that she crashed into the ocean and sank. And I know that that's also the official explanation given by the U.S. government. And so I think that that's probably a really good place to start. Let's figure out what happened when she took off, and let's figure out whether or not the official explanation is something that actually holds water, no pun intended.
Yeah, let's not make this easy. Let's throw him a curveball.
Sure.
There is so much information jammed into the series of events that comes next. And if you think about it, the entirety of this show has been leading to this very moment in time. This is our crime scene. These are the events that lead to the vanishing of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. It's important to call the right people to the stand to give the appropriate perspective on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937. Of all the people that we could call as a witness, I think we found the perfect person. And I think that after the events of day two of trial, all of you will have a solid foundation for everything that's going to come after. Now there's nothing left but to get back into the courtroom and lay this thing out. Time to swear in. Project calls Aaron Habel to the stand. Mr. Habel, you're the co-creator of the Generation Y podcast, and you've been studying true crime cases for a very long time. You covered the Earhart case in great detail early in your run, and you've been involved in the Chasing Earhart project as a guest. You have a unique general perspective to this case and can speak as an expert regarding why this case in particular has captured the imagination and the attention of the entire world for over eight decades. My first question for you today is, why are you so intrigued by this investigation, and why did Generation Y want to cover it?
Well, I wanted to cover it because one of the first shows that I ever latched onto and became a huge fan of was In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. And if you know about that show, you know they covered this case. The brilliant thing about In Search Of was it not only introduced you to the mystery of whatever they're talking about, but it gave you some of the history. And then, even though it's mystery, they made you somehow even more intrigued than you already were going into it. So if you watch that episode with Amelia Earhart, it just sucks you in and it gets you thinking, because you have this famous woman who just disappeared. And then it's like, what happened to her? And then you go through the possibilities and, oh, maybe she was seen later. And it just gets your mind working and you get excited because everybody knew who she was.
Does this case, the Amelia Earhart case, cause you to change your approach in the way that you study the investigation and everything contained within? And are there special circumstances here?
Oh, I pretty much look at it the same way. I just try to factor in who the person was, what they were doing. Is it something they were actually good at? I mean, that comes into all kinds of cases. If there's a flight that's missing, if there are people that are scuba diving, you know, what is their expertise level? And where were they headed? So you kind of try to follow where they were going. And then, you know, with her, you look at contact, radio contact. There are just so many factors here, but you take it the way you feel the evidence is leading you.
Mr. Habel, you just mentioned looking at someone's character and using it as a factor to determine what might have happened. I'd like you to elaborate on that for the court, please.
The simplest way I can put it is many of these theories that say that she crash landed somewhere and was brought back secretly or ended up in Japan and was held hostage. All these different theories don't really fit her personality to me because she was such a strong personality. She didn't bow down before anyone, let alone the government. So a lot of those theories to me just don't hold water. And I think that if she had survived, she would have made her way back and she would not have been quiet.
In your professional opinion, what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937?
I think they ended up in the water. I think it's that simple. I have a lot of respect for Amelia Earhart, and I think that if she had somehow survived and made it to land, I don't think you could stop her from getting back to America and doing this all over again. A lot of people say all these things like, oh, she must have been taken hostage and maybe she survived on this island. But I just think that Amelia Earhart is the kind of person who was always ready to get back up in the air. And the fact that she never came back to me says that she was in the water. She crashed into the water.
If indeed the Electra crashed into the ocean somewhere near Howland Island, their intended destination, then why do you think this case continues to thrive in the general public? Why is the official explanation for the events that took place that morning not enough to put this case to bed?
It's a real mystery. You know, I have my opinion, so does everyone else, but it's still a mystery. I can't say definitively, here's what happened. I can just tell you what I think based on all my reading. So as long as it's a mystery, and as long as, I mean, she's already been established as one of the most famous Americans of all time, it will continue to be a topic.
From a general historical perspective, is it really surprising to you that pertaining to her disappearance, Amelia Earhart would become such a polarizing figure?
No, not really, because she was unique at the time. I mean, she was the one that was out there trying to empower women to become pilots, saying, do this, let's do this, get out there, start flying. You know, as we know back then, women weren't really welcome in a lot of different industries or, I mean, even when it came to passion, like passion for flight, it wasn't like they couldn't do it, but no one was ushering people into that who weren't men. So she was actually saying, hey, let's do this. And she was inspiring women to fly.
Now, Mr. Habel, we all have our opinions on the events of that day and thereafter. But in the eyes of the general public, is the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan in fact solved?
No, it's unsolved. I like I said, I have my opinion. And if anyone asks, that's what I say. But there isn't enough evidence to say, yeah, this is case closed.
Do you think that'll ever change? Will we ever have a definitive answer here?
I don't think so.
Mr. Habel, one of the most fascinating pieces of information that I've come across are the letters that the Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum in Atchison, Kansas continues to receive from children all over the world who write letters to Amelia, hoping that maybe she'll write back. Do you think these types of facets add to the tragedy of a loss like this?
No, because the way I would look at it is her dream didn't die with her.
Mr. Habel, why do you think in a case like this, the government can give us a reason for a tragedy and a subsequent disappearance as a result of that tragedy, and the general public, for the most part, just doesn't buy it?
Because the government said it. It's that simple. A lot of people just don't trust the government.
We know that over 200 Freedom of Information Act requests have been filed and then denied by the U.S. government. We also know that an Earhart file does in fact exist and that very few people have seen it. My question is it possible that the United States government may know more than they let on about the events of that day?
Well, you'd be surprised, but I hear about this all the time, even on things you would consider mundane. People like to hold on to the data, and I'm not sure that they have more, but it also might be one of those things where, yeah, we get a lot of requests for Amelia Earhart information or D.B. Cooper, and they just don't care anymore. It's like, let's just move on. You guys keep messing with this, but we have modern things to worry about.
Is there a reason that the general public continues to latch onto this woman in particular? If this was anyone else, would it matter as much as it has?
Well, she stands out in history. And like I said, she pushed the envelope. And she was setting records, and she was talking. She was telling people what she wanted them to know. And she had a message. And that message got out, and somehow, even though it's 2019 now, that message continues to get out, which is pretty phenomenal. Her passion for flying was so intense that when she set about doing that, then nothing was going to get in her way. And so that singular focus is what makes people so good. Just like Bruce Lee, you know, he's one of those people that had singular focus about something. And we saw what happened with him. He became a phenomenal martial artist. And this goes for anybody doing anything. If you have that kind of focus like she had, then you can accomplish amazing things.
Mr. Habel, the court is aware, as is the jury, that Amelia Earhart was indeed very much in the aviation spotlight. But some people believe that it was a professional choice and nothing more. They believe that Amelia Earhart, the private citizen, wanted to stay just that, private. Taking that idea into account, could something like the Irene Bolam hypothesis actually carry some type of weight in this investigation?
Not liking the spotlight is a little different than I'm going to get away from my husband and get away from the life that I built up and worked so hard for.
Later, when some of the hypotheses are presented, we're going to be talking pretty heavily about eyewitness testimony. Before we get to that, though, can you please tell the court your thoughts on the merits of eyewitness testimony being used to support a given theory?
I think it can be good, but only in certain circumstances. If you just have someone who saw someone for the first time, especially, they can get it way wrong. And it's really bad. We've seen cases where people have been incarcerated, and then later it turns out they do DNA testing, and it was someone who looks somewhat like them, but it wasn't that person who got incarcerated.
In your opinion, does the amount of eyewitness testimony change anything, and do the merits of the person testifying to seeing Amelia, Fred Noonan, or the Electra make any impact on whether or not that particular evidence holds water?
Well, they saw something, but we have nothing left to present to anyone as evidence. We just have these stories. And it wouldn't surprise me that people make up stories so they can be part of something. I have a real problem with knowing how she spoke, how she conducted herself, what her personality was like, that she would just be quiet and just go away. I just don't see that. Let me just say this. I don't think they should ever stop looking. I think as long as we have people who are curious and have the means, I think they should keep the search up to try and find the answer.
Mr. Habel, a lot of people would say that the Lockheed Electra 10E that Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan vanished in would be the holy grail of aviation if ever found. Would it be fair for me to refer to this particular plane in that way?
I think that's entirely possible. Just like I said, because of who it was that was piloting the plane and the story that goes with it. And it's also, this was supposed to be her last flight like that. This was something that I guess she had set a goal, and it was possibly, maybe she felt like, hey, once I do this, I mean, where do you go from there? I mean, how do you top it? That's what I would say.
Earlier you said that you believe Amelia and Fred simply crashed into the ocean. However, by your own admission, there is no proof to that fact. And just now you stated that we should keep looking. Why, in your opinion, is it so important for this case to have an ending?
I think this could end any number of ways and still be satisfying. To me, it's satisfying that it's a mystery because it gets your mind working and you think about the possibilities and you go down all those rabbit holes. I might not put a lot of stock into many of those, but it's still interesting and I've read through them. But it might also be cool to find the plane. even if we don't find remains with it, or maybe we do find remains with it, you just never know. That could be a neat ending where we're like, okay, now we have the answer. I think, though, for some people, if you answer it, it diminishes it a little bit. Because whereas before it was a mystery, and now she's this legend that we never got back. It's almost like she did keep flying into the sunset, like in a movie. You know, it's sort of like, well, now we have the answer. And yeah, she just ditched the plane. She didn't have anything else to do. But again, this could end any number of ways, and it would still be satisfying for me. I think we should keep looking, because that's part of honoring the mystery. You know, trying to figure out which aspects work and which ones don't. But if they never find her, again, I think having her life end with a mystery is still fascinating. In fact, it might be the most fascinating ending that you can have in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Hable. No more questions. Your Honor, the project calls as its next witness, Chief Radio Operator of the USS Coast Guard Cutter Itasca, Leo Bellards. Mr. Bellards, this is an honor, sir. Thank you for your service and for being here today. Mr. Bellards, I want to start my questioning by asking you about your communication with Lei New Guinea and Harry Balfour. Can you tell us if you had any communication with them, and did they assist at all?
You know, we had no contact between the ship and Lei New Guinea. We couldn't work that distance. Of course, their frequencies were different than ours. And on the lower frequencies, you know, ship frequencies, we couldn't work that distance anyhow.
You were saying the skip in communication wasn't right for you?
No, we didn't. We didn't even pay no attention. We figured we'd get brief through the regular channels. Actually, it'd be out of Washington, Honolulu, or San Francisco, the briefing. Well, that's another story.
Can you please tell the court about your personal communications with Harry Balfour and Lei New Guinea?
I wrote him a letter. You know, in fact, I got several letters there. He says, many thanks for the information you sent me in your letter, as I did not know that you had sent out any homing signals for Amelia Earhart. He was absolutely not aware of it. He couldn't even hear the plane frequencies, eh? Even at when we started at night, he didn't hear it at all. Whether he kept track of us or not during the night of the flight or not, I don't know. Furthermore, I can guarantee that her radio equipment was in good order when she left Lei. And this guy here was an operator when I got this.
Mr. Bellards, can you read the words from Mr. Balfour's letter to you regarding what Amelia Earhart left behind with him when she left Lei New Guinea that morning?
One important factor that you ought to know is that she handed me her radio facility book the morning she left, plus a lot of papers and her pistol and ammunition. I did not see the takeoff, as I was QRL with VJZ Rabal. In other words, he was busy working traffic with Rabal, but made a QSO contact about 10 minutes later after she took off, see? And I also sent a 500 KC signal for her to check her DF if she wanted to make sure it was okay. But 500 KC was no use to her because she didn't have that, she couldn't work on that frequency. That was a sad part of it. Now inside her facility book was all her radiograms concerning her communication arrangements with the Itasca, suggested frequencies to be used, and she could not have remembered all the information that these papers contained. Perhaps she left them in the facility book by mistake. So that would account for her not keeping her schedules with you, that is, with the Itasca. I knew these papers contained all the arrangements she had made because I had a station copies of most of them. And it goes on, and some as far back as her arrangement with Batavia Radio, which was prior to Lei, see? But we corresponded quite a bit.
Did Mr. Balfour ever give you copies of anything or any indications of any kind of message that he might have received from her?
We received nothing after she took off.
You're saying that Mr. Balfour never worked her at all after she took off from Leigh?
No, no.
He never gave her any position reports that you're aware of?
Well, the only position report was if you've got that, you've got that.
Mr. Bellart's, in order to make it clear for the court, I'm going to ask you to repeat the words that she radioed to you as you wrote them down in the Itasca call logs. There's been a lot of speculation as to exactly what Amelia Earhart said and how her tone was when she spoke to you. So that the court and the jury is clear, can you please read from the Itasca call logs now?
KHAQQ to Itasca, we are on the line 157337. We will repeat north and south this on 6210. Wait. And that was it, brother.
Mr. Bellart, can you tell the court about the radio direction finder that was aboard the Itasca? Was that of any use to you at all in the search?
This was a new piece of equipment. As far as we were concerned, it was a portable, high-frequency direction finder, see? And it came from the Navy. It came from the Navy. I don't remember who brought it down, actually, but I believe the district radio electrician in Honolulu, Coast Guard District, Anthony, H.M. Anthony. I believe he arranged that we get that direction finder. It was a breadboard type, you know what I mean? With a loop on the top, you know, strictly portable. And they brought that aboard, and we had never seen it. Nobody had seen it. Cipriani the same way. So I figured, well, Cipriani would be the logical man because my man knew the ship. Cipriani didn't know the ship.
So since he didn't know the ship, he needed something to do. So you assigned him to the radio direction finder, correct?
That's right. So he went on the beach.
Now, if my research is correct, Cipriani had just joined your crew. He was new, correct?
Temporary. He was a temporary man. And so he went over on the beach, and it was just as good. Oh, and as far as that goes, you know, Cipriani was on the island for quite a long time. We didn't even pick him up. We didn't want him. He stayed with his equipment, and we took off, you know. Anyway, we had fairly good contact. That direction finder was as good as nothing.
Mr. Bellart, is it accurate for me to say that on the island, with the finder, Cipriano was only able to hear Amelia Earhart on one single instance?
He didn't know if he heard her or not, actually, I don't think. I don't think he actually positively identified her.
Well, he could hear you, correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, gee whiz, he could hear me without an antenna. That direction finder was inoperative. I didn't know it until after we came back and picked Cipriani up. Been a lot of speculation on the direction finder. kind of griped me because one person described the thing up to 400 or 500 pounds. Honest to crimey sakes, a man didn't have good sense to say something like that. I could carry it under one arm. It wasn't heavy, you know, and it didn't weigh as much as a TV, not near as much as a TV set, not by far, because one man could handle it.
Mr. Bellart, can you tell the court a little about the direction finder itself, how it was built?
If you have any idea what a direction finder is, you know, is a breadboard, the unit itself, the receiver part, and then it came up, and then there was a loop on the top. Oh, if I recall rightly, possibly maybe a foot in diameter. And when it come down, the leads from the loop, when it came down, whoever designed that should, well, he should design one more and then quit. He didn't even have slip rings in there. The wires came down, and there wasn't a stop on it either. You know, so you could turn it 180 or 360 and then it'd stop. No, there wasn't any stop on it. And when it came back aboard ship, I was very interested in it. And I looked it over and, hey, this thing's dead. And I started checking out and I looked at it and here was all the wires twisted up like a bunch of rat's tails.
Now that you've enlightened us about that, let me ask you something about the direction finder then. Howland Island reported a signal to you on a bearing of 3105. And this was when they possibly felt that they had sighted her to the north and Howland had taken a bearing that they believed to be northwest, correct?
It's possible. I don't know. As I say, I don't know when the thing went haywire.
On this log, there seems to be one point that's fallen into great contention since the log has been released, and that's fuel. At one point, Amelia mentions that she's running low on fuel and that there seems to be a contention as to whether there were 30 minutes of fuel left or whether something else was at play. Is there any way that you can clear that up for the court?
Well, the only solution is what's in the law. K-H-A-Q-Q, in other words, Amelia Earhart, calling Itasca. We must be on you, but cannot see you. But gas is running low. Now that is what's said. Now here it is, this is the rest of it. Gas is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at 1,000 feet. And bingo, she turns the thing off. Not say nothing at all, or, you know, go ahead, or this or that, or the other thing. That's what made us, as operators, disgusted with her. She would say something like that and then hang it up, and apparently wouldn't even turn the receiver on if she had the receiver off or on or what. Nothing. Until she got stuck. You know, when she saw that, boy, her number was coming up, and then she started scratching pretty much. She should have done that way the first time she heard, you know, or called us. She should have listened for it. She apparently didn't listen for us at all. That's what really disturbed us, no little bit. She'd call it, or she'd come on and just say, well, the weather's overcast, this, that, and the other thing, and hang it up. And not go ahead. She never tried to establish contact until the last quart of gas she had. Let's put it that way. We have been unable to reach you by radio, flying at 1,000 feet. We thought that was terrible, too.
Let me stop you right there, Mr. Bellarts, and argue this point. What if Amelia Earhart dropped the plane to 1,000 feet in order to get below the clouds that have been another point of contention in this case?
Those clouds were not that thick.
Was there any indication of any kind of a line of storms to the north at that time?
Not that we could see. But they were puffy clouds, you know. Just billow little cloud, and there was plenty of blue in between them.
So as she gets closer and closer, 200 miles out, then 100 miles out, she speaks the words that have gone down in history. Quote, we must be on you but cannot see you, end quote. You must have wanted to leave the Radio Shack and go outside to...
I actually did go outside and stand out right outside the Radio Shack and started listening like that, you know, thinking, well, I'm going to hear a motor any second. Actually, we had people out on deck. We thought she was going to be flying right down into our rigging the way she... Oh, man, she come in like a ton of bricks. I mean that.
Our records say that she only carried a 50-watt transmitter. There's a lot of confusion about her radio. Mr. Gurr, who installed all of her radios down in Burbank, California, Paul Mance's hangar, stated that she only carried a 50-watt transmitter. This would make her daytime 3105 signals able to put her pretty close to you.
In the early morning, you know, signals carry pretty good. In the mornings, that way, they'll carry pretty doggone good.
Mr. Bellarts, to the best of your knowledge, could the USS Ontario or the USS Swan hear her at all, or did they even have the ability to monitor for her?
Neither one of them, as far as I know, was monitoring.
And you knew that the Electra couldn't send code at all?
Well, that's why when we used code, or what we call ICW, when we used that, boy, we would go about two words a minute or slower.
Am I correct in the statement that she could have had ships take a bearing on her by simply holding down a single key?
Oh, man, yes. Yeah, actually, that direction finder, that was my pride and joy because, I've had an awful lot of experience on direction finder. Of course, now they're practically obsolete. As far as ships is concerned, they are practically obsolete.
Could the Itasca send out voice on the 7,500 kilocycles frequency?
Sure. Certainly. We can shift back and forth. Very easy.
Was there a transmitter set up for all the frequencies that morning?
We could shift to either any one of those. That's all we had to do was turn around and there you are.
Were the men on Howland, Baker, and Jarvis listening in during this whole thing?
Yes, if their batteries was up. It would, in them days, it was nothing but a dry battery outfit yet, you know, for their B batteries. And they had to charge their A batteries, so to speak. So it was a little problem there with them. As far as Baker is concerned, or Jarvis, neither one of them, they weren't in on the deal at all.
Now, you were working Baker at that time. However, we can't find anything in any log that would indicate that anyone asked them if they had heard Amelia Earhart. Is that right?
They were asked at one time and they come back negative.
Mr. Bellartz, if we can go back to the fuel aspect of the last flight, can you educate the court and our jury on what the 30-minute number or about a half-hour figure originated from?
I'll tell you how that happened, I believe. After the flight, I think it actually took place, I don't recall if it was going into Honolulu on the way north, you know, or if it was from Honolulu going back home to Frisco. I don't recall. But I remember the old man was down there, Thompson, Baker, myself. I don't know if even Sutter was there. I don't know. But anyway, the old man, Baker, and myself, and there seemed to be somebody else there, and I can't recall who that was. I don't think it was Sutter, the radio officer. But anyway, I think it was a navigator, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, we was down there, yeah, I think it was a navigator, because he had to put some of the stuff in as far as his ship's log is concerned. And they was concocting up a long letter, sort of a search report. And that, I think, was put in that report. They should never have been put in. They misquoted it. But that is what I read you. That is what came over the air.
It appears that she heard you a single time on the 7500 frequency. Is that correct?
I don't think she even tried to hear us half the time. It static, which was maximum on 3 megs. So she made a big mistake changing to 3 megs. You see, what he originally described, he said that when she was coming in, he was working on 62. And she shifted right after, apparently after she took off or something, and dropped down to 3 megs. That's all we ever heard.
Now, according to written statements from Harry Balfour, he was in contact with her for a time.
Up to the, coming in, yes.
Mr. Bellartz, when Amelia and Fred are inbound and she's communicating with you, I'm 200 miles out. I'm 100 miles out. We must be on you but cannot see you. When reading the logs, it doesn't come across as if they felt they were lost. So what I want to ask you now is, was there any change in her demeanor, the tone of her voice, anything?
Actually, her voice, we could hear her voice just as easy as I'm hearing yours right now, and I'm deaf in one ear now. But I tell you, you could hear it all over the shack and even outside the shack, you know. Real loud and clear, I mean it. She was a woman. We heard her quite a few times, you know. But that last one, I'm telling you, it sounded, if she would have broken out in a scream, it would have sounded normal. She was just about ready to break in tears and go into hysterics. That's exactly the way I describe her voice, and I'll never forget it. But I tell you, she was just on the verge, I mean, of just saying, oof, and letting it go. She was just on the verge of going into hysterics. I mean that.
Thank you, Mr. Bellartz, for your testimony today. No further questions. Your Honor, at this time, I'd like to call a recess and reconvene 2 weeks from tonight with the crash and sink hypothesis.
All rise.
This is Amber.
And Andrew from Into the Portal podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished Amelia Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media where our team posts all our episodes as they air, news, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/vanishedAmeliaEarhart and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @vanishedAE. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes and rate us and leave a review. It really helps get the word out. And if you want to join the conversation with our hosts and guests, head to Facebook and search the group Vanished Amelia Earhart to get in on the conversation.
Vanished Amelia Earhart is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Chris Williamson. Podcast music is provided by Dane Garrish-Schmidt. The opinions on Vanished Amelia Earhart are those of individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. Vanished Amelia Earhart is the exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc. and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. A Vanished Amelia Earhart is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2019. All rights reserved.